cobra. La 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 la.
And that sound means it's the beginning of another Missile for the Masses. This is the Chaplain's Assistance Motor Pod, the podcast where I, your host Gary, take a deeper look into the vehicles, playsets, or even the trailers from the G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, 3¾ and 4-inch toy lines from 1982 to present day. This is Missile number 57, and number 57 makes me think of Heinz ketchup, which, if you ask Airtight, doesn't belong on a burger. But ketchup is red. Red means Crimson Guard. And I really got to thinking, you know, I wanted to do maybe something Crimson Guard related. You know, there is the Sears SMS set. There's, you know, that's also leading into the potential repaint of a classified Hiss, as the SMS has been announced for the classified line. You know, there were other Crimson Guard related repaints, but going a little darker red, more like a Hunt's ketchup red, is the Firebat. And the Firebat belongs to the Terrordrome, which also came with the AVAC. So that's right, for the 57th Missile for the Masses. Today, for the big end of 2023 blowout, we're looking at the Cobra Terrordrome from 1986. Now, to start every view of the G.I. Joe toy line, start off with looking at the box, the marketing materials to the 1986 child of what they saw when they saw this big box. And I hesitate to say giant because I know while it is probably the third largest box behind the Defiant and Flag, the box starts off as the G.I. Joe 1986 three-dimensional logo, G.I. Joe, Cobra the Enemy. You know, and then underneath G.I. Joe it says a Cobra Command Weapon, Cobra Terrordrome with Firebat. The secret launch mechanism activates silo doors and elevator raises Firebat for launch. Weapons do not shoot. And we have this painterly image, a little bit of a fisheye view centering on the jail cell, the brig, where it's holding Dial Tone. And in front, kneeling, is Dr. Mindbender. You have the Crimson Twins coming, one coming through each door, left and right. And I would say it's Zaymot on the right. And then behind Zaymot in the next, in the door gunner position, we have Serpentor ordering a bat or buzzer. Buzzer's firing the door gun up into the air as in a, you know, anti-aircraft position. And the bat's running across with the flamethrower weapon attached to his hand. In the little corner box, we get to see the AVAC, but then we'll move over to our left and we'll take a look at Monkey Wrench working on a ferret, all 16 valves per cylinder, and we got Torch in the bay behind Monkey Wrench. Now up top, we have the Firebat with the AVAC firing off from the middle. We don't see the top of the Terrordrome in this image. We have the Cobra logo from one of the panels, front and center. And also firing off into the air are each of the two turret guns, the left one manned by a Viper and the right one manned by a Crimson Guard. We have Xandar firing an arrow towards the ground. And then next to him is Storm Shadow firing an arrow in the opposite direction, or he's getting ready. He has aimed his bow. And then moving again over to the right, we have Ripper firing a pistol, and we have a Televiper firing off a rifle. It looks like Dusty's FAMAS, because he's firing it with his right hand in the middle of the gun. It looks like behind that is the magazine, and then he's holding with his left hand onto the butt of the machine gun. It conveys, you know, what excitement is in this. It's highlighting several 1986 characters on the box, but really surprised with how many dreadnoughts this is highlighting on the box rather than just Cobra forces. 1986 was the last year that Storm Shadow was offered. So he was available in 1986. All the characters on the box were featured in 1986. So, but a lot of them were originally from 1985. So when the Terrordrome was available in 1987, you probably weren't going to be able to get your hands on a Crimson Guard, Televiper, Ripper, Buzzer, Torch, the Crimson Twins. So that is, or Storm Shadow. So kind of an odd mix, especially the Dreadnoughts. I would think this would be much more high tech. But again, the other neat feature, and we'll get into this later, is why it features so many 1985 characters. And looking at the back of the box, and again, I want to credit 3djoes.com for providing great high-resolution images to look at the Terrordrome box, because I do not own one of these, shows, you know, more play features and more characters on the back. And it says, "This insidious fortress lies deep within Cobra forests. It's based on Cobra Command's top secret designs and includes some of the most sophisticated technology in Cobra's weapons arsenal." And to match my point from earlier, why would you have the Dreadnoughts? So it's going to point out all the fun features of the Terrordrome. We have the Firebat. It says removable engine covers, opening canopy, articulated wings, and removable rockets and bombs. One thing that they're showing on the Firebat is the engine covers on the Firebat on the back of the box are blue, while the Firebat is red. So we know that is a prototype. And then we have lower launch lever, silo doors open, and elevator raises Firebat. And it's pointing out, and just to say on the top of the Terrordrome on this, this is a much more top view than the front of the box. So we get to see on the top, in the top of the, near the silo, we have a Televiper manning one of the turret guns. We have a Cobra, you know, sitting in the seat, you know, working at one of the control panels. We have Zartan. We have Tomax and Zaymot, another Cobra trooper, Zarana. There's an AVAC looking at the opening silo. We have Firefly. We have Scrap Iron. We have a Viper in the other turret. And then we finish off with Serpentor, Dr. Mindbender, and then bringing us full circle is a Cobra Bat with the claw attachment. So nice. So we got a little busy base going on. Everything's going on. And then we go to the bottom and one of the bay doors, you know, garage bay floors extend out. Six lower bay doors close. Super realistic detail. Door guns elevate. Sturdy construction for rugged play. Another thing to talk about later. We have fuel station. Armored rampart walls. You know, we have computer station. And then let's go back to the characters rounding out the bottom of the box. We have Ripper, Storm Shadow, Torch, Xandar. And then we have Buzzer filling up a ferret with some gasoline and a Crimson Guardsman looking like he's going to get on the ferret. And this is 10 flag points. So we all know that this was a very expensive toy, well, playset and toy. And it, for many people, this would be considered a grail item. I think this is an expensive item and it is, you know, somewhat attainable, but it is, you know, this is a big base. The box is pretty big. I mean, this thing is 24 inches in diameter. It takes up some real estate in your collection. So however you store your collection, however you display your collection, this is kind of a centerpiece. Much like my flag is the centerpiece of my room, this would be the centerpiece of, let's say, a Cobra layout. So this thing's big. There's room for lots of figures. It is a great or easy to photograph, you know, diorama. It's very easy to set up little scenes in each of these bays. Let's dig into the contents of this box. We'll start with the character AVAC. AVAC was designed by Ron Rudat, who designed, you know, so much of the early G.I. Joe line. And the AVAC came with a parachute, much similar to that of Ripcord's, where it is not a plug-in-the-back type parachute. It is a fold-over parachute that slips over his head, and you have two clips on either side that goes into pegs. Simpler than Ripcord's parachute. I actually like it a lot. The parachute also features the Cobra logo on the back because branding is important. And there's also, of the backpack, there's like two variations. One is very rubbery and one is more harder. I wouldn't say plastic, but it's a harder rubber. So it makes me almost think that, you know, there's a, you know, rubber to me, you know, that's a chemical compound that's mixed and poured, much like plastic. So there might have just been different, let's call it recipes for the rubber for during the AVAC's production run. One interesting thing, and again, I'm going to be using also for reference, Creating G.I. Joe, Volume 10 by Dan Klingensmith, is looking at the color studies by Ron Rudat. Is there's one time when the AVAC was, where the AVAC as we know it is red cloth with silver features for like armor and helmet. AVAC, one color of study of AVAC was blue cloth with black armor. And then there's another color study that's very similar to what we got, but with a red helmet, not a silver helmet. Overall, very faithful to the original design. Before we actually talk about the figure, let's talk about the file card. Codename AVAC, Cobra Pterodrome Firebat Pilot. Piloting a Firebat is somewhat akin to strapping yourself onto a cannonball. The cockpit is cramped by any standard and utterly lacking in even the kindest amenities. No engine status display, no weather instruments, no navigation aids, and no ejection seat. Just the basic flight panel, throttle, pedals, and stick. But after the initial high Gs of vertical takeoff, the Firebat levels out to being the fastest, most responsive single-seat fighter in the Cobra arsenal. So this first half of the file card, I'm going to say, doesn't really describe our character, the AVAC. It describes the Firebat. Now the quote, AVAC pilots are drawn from the air viper pool. They must be capable of complex mental calculations to make up for lack of onboard computers and absolutely fearless to cope with the Firebat's basic unforgiving nature. The aircraft is not what you would call user-friendly. Surprisingly, there is no lack of recruits for the program. All the best fighter jocks want to ride on the Pocket Rocket. The only thing I wish they told me was what AVAC stands for, and going on a yojo.com, I found the file card from 2008, which does explain what AVAC stands for, and if you didn't know this, it stands for Air Viper, which is what I assumed, and the AC stands for Advanced Class. So there you have it. That's what AVAC stands for. Now, to take a look at the figure itself, the figure was molded in red plastic all over, and then everything else is painted on it. So that creates some interesting things when the paint rubs off during play. So he's going to start from the feet moving up to the head. We have black boots with silver soles, silver accents on each side of the ankle for ankle support, and going up to silver shin guards that extend all the way up to the knee. You know, the cloth that's covering is red and plastic. We move up to the legs, the thighs, and we have silver armor there as well. And over the left thigh, we have a pistol, you know, painted black. The grip is black into that silver holster. Then we get up to the waist piece with a black belt going through some loops, and we have some silver accents covering the groin and also as like straps to hold up the leg armor. We go up to his chest and we have a silver breastplate with a black Cobra logo, very similar to Ron Rudat's original design with thick horizontal lines, not the thin lines that were from earlier in the series. He has silver epaulets with a silver collar. He has shoulder armor over the top parts of his upper arms. And moving down past the elbow, we have black gloves with silver bracelets and accents over the top of the glove or the back of the glove near the elbow. And again, it's all molded in red. So we do have a little bit of red plastic syndrome. It is common to see hairline cracks on the elbows, you know, for whatever it is, the red plastic they used, especially in 86, it's like the stun, you know, it dries out, it air gases, it ages, and it gets brittle with age. Then we move up to the head, which has a red neck, which tells you, no, he's not from the South. He is not a hillbilly. He is painted silver helmet. So when the silver paint, which across the G.I. Joe toy line, silver paint or metallic paint is more fragile than the solids, the solid colors. Nose rub is very common on the AVAC, you know, so the helmet starts wearing away and you see red spots all over. Very common to see a red spot on the back of his head, on the front of his head, top. You know, you're stuffing him into that tight, cramped firebat bay, which we'll get to in a moment, and it wears like crazy. The helmet is like a stormtrooper design. He has a black goggles. He has a singular mouthpiece. Also could say it's like a motocross helmet. And he has like earmuffs slash speakers that go across his ears. And he has like a thicker back portion of his helmet. Overall, it is a very handsome figure. I'm by himself, if you're looking for an AVAC, you know, he can be an expensive figure to find in great shape. He can be even more expensive if you're looking for his parachute as well. Not entirely uncommon to find, just hard to find for sale in nice shape. And in nice shape, as of 2023, it is like an $80 to $100 figure, depending on the seller, the bidding, and, you know, and what's going on. Generally, my experiences with eBay for pricing things. So again, you know, that's subject to change as this podcast gets older. Now, moving on to the Firebat and starting again with creating G.I. Joe, is the Firebat was originally called the Stinger and was designed by Todd Wise, and it was partially inspired by the Rutan Long Easy aircraft. The other thing is, too, is if you watch the Sunbow G.I. Joe series, you'll see in the first season, not the first two miniseries, but, you know, the first season that introduced, you know, Flynn, Airtight, Barbecue, and the rest of the 1985 cast, in some episodes, you will see the Firebat. And you'll also see the AVAC as well. Now, I've always asked myself, were these toys planned for a 1985 release? And yes, they were. Well, I'm pretty sure why they would put the Terradrome out the following year in 1986, because, well, 1985 had the flag, the proof of concept of, can a toy line support a giant playset? And it would be really hard one year to have two toy playsets coming out at the same time. So 1986 is probably one of the pinnacle years for G.I. Joe sales. With everything hitting the cartoon, the comic book, it's riding a crest of popularity as it's growing. So I can see why the Terradrome might have been pushed back 1 year. But again, these things were in development. And while things are in development, you're going to go to the animators and be like, yeah, we're working on this. It should be coming out in 1985. And the animators and the storytellers, you know, they develop a story with these toys that are coming out and they send them over to Korea where they get animated. And, you know, next thing you know, oh, well, you know, this isn't coming out. Well, you know, these things happen. They did come out, which is a good thing. And if they haven't come out yet, we always have Super 7 potentially coming out with stuff in the new year. And I'll cover that on another podcast. The Stinger, now known as the Fire Bat, is a maroon aircraft that would be later released as a mail-away in a brighter shade of red, and the gray would also be slightly different as well. And we'll take a quick look at the blueprints. You know, number one, it's pointing to the canopy, and it's calling the front of the canopy, so I would assume that this is underneath the canopy by the AVAX foot, the fire control radar. Looking at the toy itself, with more detail, that's basically a little gray box that's molded into the seat piece, you know, a little square box. And I can buy that being as a radar with a little, you know, sensor dish inside rotating around, gathering data for, I don't know what, because the Firebat has basic instrumentation based on the file card. Number two points to the infrared HUD, heads-up display imaging. So that's essentially the sticker that you place on the inside of the canopy for the Firebat. A lot of kids, you know, placed it on the outside. That's the way it kind of shows on the blueprints. Number three is the air induction vents, and it points off to what is a black piece of plastic on the top of the fire bat in the toy. It's essentially like a scalloped or louvered detail. And basically they face forward for catching air. Not sure why something so aggressive would be on this jet unless it's an additional air intake for the engine. But that doesn't match with the bulge of the engine covers with their vents as well. But it is a nice detail. It could also be like something where they had planned a button where you press it down to release the canopy. You move over to number four, the epoxy composite engine covers. And those are basically two red pieces that are on either side of the Firebat. And they come off by pressing down on the top and then just pivoting them out to reveal the jet engine underneath. And then number five, we go over and we look at these bulges on the wings. And they call them the internal fuel tanks. And this makes sense because in many aircraft, they store the fuel in the wings. Number six is the Cobra Jet F-404 afterburning turbojet. That's the engine that is revealed when you remove the engine covers. And I gotta say, I love the little detail on that, especially with the engine covers removed. It is exactly one of those things where I think the G.I. Joe line, again, these toys were essentially model kits. Very durable snap together model kits. We have details of fuel lines and, you know, rivets in general, a realistic scaled down engine for the Firebat. It is wonderful, molded in gray with the nozzle being a separate piece from the main body, just the way it assembles. We get to number seven, the vertical stabilizer winglets. So those are the essentially the winglets that are very tall on the extreme ends of each one of the wings that fold down. And you know, what those are used for in aircraft is to force air over the wings to generate more lift. I don't know why they have to be so tall. You know, if you've ever flown commercial, you know, on a Boeing like 737, you see little winglets. They don't have to be that tall to force the air over the wing, because it's essentially acting at that point, it's acting kind of like a wall to prevent air from flowing off the wing, you know, to losing lift. We got to eight, the air-to-surface Condor bombs. Those are the four bombs each side of the wings. Then we have number nine, the super reinforced titanium folding wing. That's pretty cool. They're using titanium. Titanium is what the SR-71 Blackbird was made out of. And, you know, what also from 1986 is reminiscent of the SR-71? Oh, yes, it is the Cobra Night Raven. So lots of titanium going on. I think Cobra Commander and Destro are getting getting that from the USSR at that period. The USSR, or now Russia, is where most of the titanium in the world is mined from. Then we get to number 10, the Hydrag Mark 38 Snake Eye Guidance Bomb. And I just want to say that Snake Eye is spelled S-N-A-K-E-Y-E. So they definitely don't want you to confuse it with Snake Eyes. And, you know, that is a little bit longer. I've always played with it or imagined it as a missile. But now that I know it's a guidance bomb, I'm still going to play with it like a missile. So there's two of those. They peg closer to the center of the airplane, the fuselage. We move on to number 11, the horizontal stabilizing front canards. Again, the main wings are located in the rear of the Firebat. That gives it high maneuverability, but less stability. So like the Conquest X-30, we have front canards to provide a leveling function or stabilizing function. Number 12 is the 25mm twin coaxial firing cannons. And they peg in. There's two little pegs. They are easily taken on and off. They are commonly lost. You know, 25mm, that's a good size round. I don't know how much it's holding. The ammunition, I would say, is literally under the legs of the AVAC. Glad it's there. It's good to have some dogfighting capability on this. And for the size of this aircraft, with the size of those guns, that's pretty hefty firepower indeed. We get to number 13, the layered composite titanium body. And then finally, number 14, the vertical landing strut wheel assembly. So this lands vertically. And I would say this is probably the first one to do so with the Cobra Stellar Stiletto following up in 1988. Vertical landing has always surprised me because you almost have to do, and it's funny now that it's known as in the aviation community as the Cobra maneuver. A lot of videos of it on YouTube and such, but also probably what made it very famous was Top Gun Maverick. And I just think it's funny because it's called the Cobra maneuver and you know what we're talking about. Now, taking a look at the toy, my experience with the Firebat is I did restore two Firebats a long time ago, and I have the one in front of me now using the wonderful stickers from Toy Hacks. You know, I rebuilt this, so we have the gray seat for the AVAC has detail to mimic stitching or a seat pattern. It has some detail between the legs. And then, again, you have the radar at the forward that would be by his ankles. What could benefit? A peg-out joystick. I'm not familiar with the 25th anniversary, but if it had that, I would say that is a huge win for the Firebat. The Firebat is also entirely cramped to get the AVAC into. He will not fit with his parachute on, which is kind of a lost opportunity, but also thinking about it is the Firebat had to be small enough to fit into the Terradrome. So making the Firebat bigger to accommodate, you know, features like the parachute would make the Firebat longer. Maybe it's very narrow. If you're ever trying to finagle an AVAC in, you have to put one shoulder in, one elbow in, and then stuff it into that one side and then tilt them down and then, you know, center them back. So it is tightly cramped in there. The red plastic, the maroon, a lot of times it's easily scratched from play, just because most of the time, like in the cartoon, you land it like a traditional airplane. The stickers add stuff to it. I like the way they pop, the white and the yellow pops against the deep maroon. If you have the mail-away Firebat, it would be a brighter shade of maroon. It would almost be like a deep red. It's very hard to explain. Much like the gray plastic is a darker gray plastic. So it's almost like they darken the gray, but lighten the red. You have the black accents of the landing gear that is clipped into each side of the, which reside on the sides. In other words, it's a short and stubby aircraft. It is, like what they call on the file card, a pocket rocket. I'm glad that they described it as dangerous as it would be in real life. But when you add the engine covers to it, it adds a little bit more meat to this. And the only way that I think that the Firebat could be improved would be at the cost of making the Terradrome that much taller or that much wider. So overall, I really like the Firebat. So that brings us to the main portion of the Terradrome playset, and that is the Terradrome itself, originally known as the SLAM, the Strategic Launch Attack Module. So the SLAM acronym would be reused in 1987 for the G.I. Joe SLAM. And this was designed by Stephen Rice, and he took inspiration from 2001, A Space Odyssey, from the moon base there. This is such a big playset, it came with two sheets for instructions. So the Firebat had its own set of blueprints, the Terradrome had another set of blueprints, and it also had another sheet for sticker placement. So this was a very complex toy in 1986. So with a quick summary of the blueprints, we have number one, the reinforced heavy armor Cobra Battle Rampart. So it is pointing to the shields with the Cobra logos. There are six of them on the Terradrome, with one separating the two laser cannon command seats. We have number two, the Vehicle Diagnostic Analysis Service Bay. So there are three of them. They are all adjacent to each other as you go around. Just to quickly put things in perspective as I keep describing this, the Terradrome is essentially eight compartments surrounding the center silo. So these three next to each other, you know, with the sliding out service bays, they're all next to each other. So we've taken up three out of the eight. We get to the radome reinforced cannon tower. So that is essentially the, what I like to call the ramparts, but the gunner turrets, where the two main guns sit atop the Terradrome. And then we get to the perimeter defense sensor scanners. That is pointing to the turret bases. So not sure why they would call that. There are plenty of detail inside the upper command center of the Terradrome. We got the munition storage depot. That is one compartment that surrounds the silo. And then we have the launch silo activation chamber. So we are now on our fifth compartment, and that is the lever that you will pull down to that, which simultaneously retracts the eight triangular doors in Raises the Fire Bat. We then get to number 8, the prisoner containment chamber, sometimes called a brig, sometimes called a jail. This is, you know, where, you know, you detain your prisoners. And then you have your energy field containment door, which is the door that locks Dial Tone in place. We have the launch preparation workstation, which basically points to an empty wall on the pterodrome. So not sure why they did that, but there are different gray areas on the top. Then we get the thermal computer emission vent. So basically there are vents around the top of the pterodrome, and basically that's where the computers cool down. You know, 1980s technology, computers ran hot, and don't put your characters over that. Or maybe you do that, so when you're playing a fight scene, you know, maybe, you know, the characters will sweat a little bit, especially in Sierra Gorda, where you're not going to be sweating at all. You get to the launch silo thermal thrust vents. Those are these little rectangular slats that go around the pterodrome's top. And the pterodrome's top has almost like two levels, where basically the top level is just like one step up and the bottom level is the step down. And in between it are these little vents that are rectangular in fashion. And then we get to number 13, the launch silo blast shields. And those are the 8 pieces that fold back as the fire bat comes up. They're also known for having the Cobra symbol stickers on each one of those. The 8 stickers make up one Cobra logo. Number 14 are the fire control launch silo command seats. There are 4 of them, molded in red. They, you know, sit very well. They don't have a back peg for the character to snap in, so that makes them handy to come in and out. And then we get number 15, the fire control guidance monitors. And those have nice little stickers where it shows essentially a Mobat or Mauler targeted on the left side. And then on the right side is a radar, you know, showing, you know, the battle conditions going on. 16 is the launch preparation perimeter level, so we can call that the upper level. And then 17 is the laser cannon command seat. So that seat has a backpack plug to plug your character in, so they don't fall off as they're shooting off the 2 main cannons, which is number 18, the tower-mounted white heat laser cannons. And which finally brings us to 19 and 20, the blast door-mounted laser cannons, and number 20, the swing-out blast door strut dampened. Essentially, you have the 2 doors that swing out. There's one left-hand, one right-handed. And the laser cannons with the caps are inside, and, you know, your character is seated behind, like Buzzer on the artwork and on the front of the box. And the doors, because they are hinged, has essentially a kickstand, which is what they're calling a strut, dampened, essentially, to support it when it's in the open position. That's it for the blueprints. Now, let's talk about the pterodrome itself. And a lot of these parts are fragile with age. A lot of them broke with heavy play. This is a fragile toy. It is not that hard to get unbroken. It can be a challenge if you're doing this on a budget, like the way I did. What I did was I bought multiple pterodromes and I built one for myself. And if you're an early listener of this podcast, early on, I restored the one that I have now. I used Toy Hack stickers. And out of 3 pterodromes that I bought, I went out and I found it on a Craigslist ad and purchased it, brought it home. And then the next 2 were purchased with collections. And each one had good parts. Each one had bad parts. and using a water hose and a bathtub and lots of elbow grease and, you know, Dawn detergent and everything, and just really cleaning it up, I was able to build the one that I'm looking at now. The second one, I was able to put together another second one, 100%, and I sold it to one of my friends. And then finally, I have the third one, which is essentially 75% there. It's been sitting in my basement. I've tried selling it, but I don't want to ship another one, especially one that is not 100%. It's just too much of a pain, hassle, and yada, yada, yada. So common things to look out for with a terror drum, especially with all the parts. So the upper part, the turret, the place where all the computers and the chairs are, that will discolor with age, get brittle. It will crack. One of mine, actually, the one that's now with my friend, after I cleaned it, some mice had chewed those little rectangular vents. You know, things to watch out for, you know, storage. But then the big thing is you have the door clips. So the swing out doors, the, you know, number 20, the swing out blast door, those hinges have a tendency to break on the top. And there is a 3D printed fix for those. If you search on Facebook or on G.I. Joe forums, you can find the person that makes them and sells them, or maybe even the STL files, which the solid models. The other thing to watch out for on those blast doors is there's four clips for the strut, for the dampened strut, and those are common to crack as well. So those are the swing out doors. That's what's common to break. Then you have the black base. Now the black base has four clips for the flip down doors. Those flip down doors generally don't have too many issues. You might see a broken hinge on the bottom of them, but chances are those didn't break. It was the clips on the black base that broke. The one that I have in my basement has a couple of those. Next up is the turret bases. So the upper turrets, the parapets, those are common to be broken from, you know, kids leaning or pushing down on them. Those are quite possibly the most expensive part of a terror drome. This blue plastic also will, as it ages, it will fade almost to a black or a very brownish blue. Like the gray doors will also fade a little bit with time as well. Again, heat and UV on plastic is bad. So once these are completed and restored and, you know, maybe retrobrided, you need to maintain these or keep them in a safe, moisture-free, light-free environment. You know, don't use fluorescents or incandescents. You're using LEDs. Then the other thing I would say is, so my restoration, I use Toy Hacks decals, like my fire bat, and by and large, they are fantastic. However, the only thing I wasn't pleased with was the Cobra decals, the eight triangular Cobra decals that for the silo doors, the eight triangular silo doors that close up. Mine still bubble. They still lift. I've tried pushing them down using a little bit of Elmer's glue, try to keep them down, but it's just, I'm trying not to make a mess out of it. Out of the only thing that I would do next time with a terror drome is I would find a new set, or new set to me, doors with the original stickers on them. Other than that, the Toy Hacks decals were fantastic. I loved them. It worked out really well. Easily lost pieces, and I should have mentioned this with the broken pieces, are the fuel nozzles. The fuel nozzles, I've had a couple broken ones. In the slide-out trays, the clips and stuff will break on those as well. And they're easily lost. The Terradrome originally came with four nozzles for the three stations. So if you have an extra one with your Terradrome, that's not an error. They were molded in two little red trees of two. Now, the same orange that makes the slide-out trays are the laser caps for the two turrets and the two door gunners. Now, they look a lot like wire nuts that is used in home wiring, but they're not. And especially the door ones, I found the smaller of the sets. There's, you know, the ones on the main parapets are larger than the ones on the door. The ones on the door are harder to find and thus command more of a price. Well, other than that, everything else is rather, I would say, sturdy or not affected by, you know, there's not stressed. So there isn't much in the way of losing the Terradrome. Now that I've covered the toy, talk a little bit about how it was used. And obviously the Terradrome was used extensively in the second season of the G.I. Joe cartoon series. And it is a feature of the G.I. Joe movie from 1987. In that context, it is very prominent and very important. Now you go back to the comic book from the 1980s, and the Terradrome is important there as well, being used as a plot point in the 50s, as with looking up the plans and, you know, Snake Eyes infiltrating it dressed as Flynn, and then they blow it up and then they bring it down to the train. And then it came back again during the Frozenland storyline of them setting it up and using the ultra low frequency sound waves to drive people to anger and violence. The final portion of the Marvel era where the Terradrome was prominent was the Benzene War from issue 108 to 115, where Falcon's team had escaped from raiding Terradromes in Trucial Abysmia. And then at the end of the Benzene War was they installed secretly a Terradrome after making a deal with the Emir. So the Terradrome in the vintage era is very significant in its use in media. Now, the Terradrome does get some use in the IDW era, most notably when Grunt and Lola went to Sierra Gordo and to rescue the Joe team. So again, the Terradrome still features and it still inspires. Now in play, how does the Terradrome? It is, again, like I said earlier, it is a centerpiece. There are a lot of different situations to use the Terradrome. You can use the Terradrome for planning attacks against G.I. Joe or planning terrorist events. You can use the Terradrome as a base, much like the 1983 G.I. Joe headquarters, where you're servicing your Cobra vehicles, filling them up with gas, using it as a launch bay, and with defensive capabilities. Then, again, it's the Firebat launch base. You can use it as a point of a Cobra base where Cobra has established a foothold and is conducting their operations. It's not a vehicle, so it isn't going to move around, but that's what you got the Firebat for. Every compartment around the base has detail that can be used. Even the plainest one has ammo boxes stolen from other molds, like the ammo dump. So there's something everywhere. The plainest area is where the launch bat control is. So that's where you put your hand in, you press down on the lever, the Firebat goes up using a ball chain. The round spots, you know, with the doorways, there's a door in between each one. You know, you can create a moving, like on the cover of the box, you can create a moving diorama. Now the top is great because you have all those little stations for Cobras to monitor what's going on, to engage the enemy, to, you know, work on computers and whatnot. It is a full display. There's a lot of story to tell with the Terradrome. Now, who do I have in my Terradrome? Well, the Terradrome's great because its design is from, you know, 1985, 1986. So that puts G.I. Joe or the Cobra like in the middle of that point where they became more of an enemy fighting force rather than just terrorists. So while having a Cobra trooper or Cobra officer from 83, it doesn't look out of place. Neither does a Viper from 86. Neither does a snow serpent from 85, an eel. Well, maybe not so much an eel because there's not much water to do. But then again, you put this on stilts, this could be a water base. Looking in the forward, though, a frag viper, heat viper, you know, none of those Cobra Troopers look out of place. Even a 1991 Cobra Commander doesn't look out of place. This, it has a timeless look to it that while it is steeped in mid-80s, it transcends beyond that because its industrial architecture doesn't age. Now, where do I rate the Cobra Terror Drome? On a scale of 0 to 5 white heat laser cannons, looking at its importance in media, looking at how it's crafted and how it holds up, and just in general, where it belongs in the storytelling of G.I. Joe, the only detractor it being its size, which may be an issue for some collectors. In my opinion, this is a 4.75 out of 5 white heat laser cannons. I think this belongs in just about every collection as long as that collector can physically fit it in their displaced place. And finally, thank you, listeners, for joining me on this, the 57th Missile for the Masses. I've been your host, Gary. And if you've enjoyed this, feel free to rate and review wherever you listen to this podcast, as it only helps to grow and improve this pod. The Chaplain Sisters Motor Pod is hosted by Spotify for Podcasters. And if you're listening on Spotify, you also have the ability to answer the question and poll that accompanies this post. For more Chaplain Sisters Motor Pod, you can follow me on social media at Chaplain Joe Pod on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Blue Sky, and other social media platforms. You can also reach out to chaplainjoepod at gmail.com if you would like to send an email, or if you want to support the show, write an email to that and I can be able to hook you up with a t-shirt, maybe my fine friends over at robertbaronsinc.com. The Chaplain Sisters Motor Pod is the strange but not estranged nerdy little brother of The Pint, a pop culture podcast. Now, with all of that out of the way, one final missile for the masses. Be decent to each other.